sit down.
All right, sweet. Well, hi, everybody. My name's America. I am an alcoholic. Sorry, I project. It's for real. Okay. My sobriety date is July 15th, 1991. And I have that time because I'm just absolutely moved beyond my own reality right now by how many old-timers are in this room. I would not be sober if it wasn't for the old-timers. Absolutely not. And I also would not have made it through as easily as I was able to make it through COVID. I had an old-timer Zoom meeting, and you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous 3 weeks after my 19th birthday, and my drunkalogue can be summarized as follows. I was drinking a gallon of vodka every 2.5 days, and I was coming out of blackouts driving all the time. And I have no idea why I never got a DUI. Oh, I mean, it's God, obviously, but I mean, it's miraculous, actually. And that's just the times I remember coming out of a blackout. You know, I drank myself, I went to Arizona State for a minute and got an AA degree in alcoholism, and managed to be the first student that semester who drank herself to a 0.3 blood alcohol level. And that's the way that I drank. I mean, I just drank. You see, this used to be filled with vodka. I just consume unbelievable amounts of alcohol. And what I didn't know was happening was that I was experiencing the phenomenon of craving. That was real news to me when I got here. I was under the delusion that I just really liked to party. And that's why I love convention so much. You know, the energy and the love that goes in from the people that volunteer their time, it's such a selfless act, and it's so appreciated. If I haven't had a chance to thank you personally, I've been really trying to get around and thank each member personally. Please know that I am so sincerely grateful that anybody would want me around, period, because when I got sober, that was so far from reality, it's not even funny. And my last drunk, I came out of a blackout, and my two girlfriends were dragging me. I had passed out in the jacuzzi, and they were laying out, and somebody happened to sit up and see me in there, and that's the way that I drank. People that can go on and drink and be quasi-functional is my head. I mean, seriously, I do not understand. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't hold a job. My family wanted nothing to do with me. And I was completely non-functional. You know, functional alcoholics. And, you know, people tell me, you know, that oftentimes they say, oh, I wish I got here sooner or whatever. You know, here's the thing, is that we have literally no control over when God taps us on the shoulder and says, this isn't working for you anymore. No control. And if that is outside of our control, then there is no regret. Because when I got here, I had no belief in God at all. And the idea that came to me that I was going to have to get a relationship with a higher power was terrifying, because I didn't think I could do it. And I knew, you know, the reason that I'm still here, the book talks about being beat into a state of reasonableness. And I absolutely was. I had a moment of clarity that every problem in my life was because of my drinking. And it was just staring me in the face, and there was nothing that I could do but change what I was doing. And, you know, prior to that, I would have thought that all of my problems were because of my father. And I love the theme. And by the way, thank you. I should probably preface this. I usually do this, which is I never plan what I'm going to say ever, never, ever, because my old timers told me if I am, I'm worried about sounding good. And I just pray that someone here gets something that they need tonight. And if anybody else gets anything, then that's like icing on the cake for me. There's nothing that I feel is more important than being of service to another alcoholic. And this is like to the power of 392. I mean, you know what I mean? That's just amazing to me. And I will also do my very best to not swear. I will really try. And because I don't plan what I say, because if I do, then I put a filter on, and then I've tried to do that, and I was not satisfied with what came to me. So I will do my best. I used to say, I'll do my damnedest. Okay, we got that out of the way, okay? I'm just saying. I was so incredibly broken when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the theme of this, you know, the language of the heart and, you know, emotional sobriety and all of the things that come along, it's kind of what I call upper division AA. And, you know, my old timers told me that I had a really hard time with sponsorship. If you're new and you're struggling with sponsorship, don't feel like, I mean, if you're really trying, not just like, you know, your head's trying to kill you. But I really, 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 really struggled with sponsorship because I couldn't find somebody that I couldn't sell a bad idea to. And I come from a, you know, family of salespeople, so that's how that goes. And but then I would just go, you know, hopping in thinking I got permission to go do something, and I would tell it to my old timers. And like every time, it was like I had a plunger on my forehead. You know, I mean, they would just look at me like, are you effing stupid? And would often say that. And I have to tell you that's what I needed. Some people talk about AA, you know, being like, they feel like they're at home. I did feel like I was at home, but I just, you know, when you're 19 years old, I mean, whether you're sober or not, you're a friggin' idiot, entitled, you know, just, you know everything, but you're as stupid as you can possibly be because you don't have any life experience really yet. And that's a dangerous combination for someone like myself. And my old timers, we are beyond human aid. But I can tell you, I know that God has spoken to me through people, and in particular, my old timers. In my life. And when I was a kid, I'm blind in one eye, just as a side note, so sports was extremely difficult for me. And I used to play tennis. My sister and I played tennis, and she'd always beat me because she was older than me. And I told my mother, I said, I don't want to play tennis with her anymore. I'm tired of losing. And she said, every once in a while, when I was growing up, I would hear like a fundamental truth and know it in the moment that was like a truth. And what she told me, she said, in your life, you need to be around people that have a better skill set than you because they will be better. I promise you one day you'll play somebody your age and you'll beat them. And she was right. And when I got sober, I didn't want a year of sobriety. I wanted 65 years of sobriety. I wanted all of the sobriety because I so didn't want what I had anymore. And so as far as I'm concerned, if somebody's got, they've managed to get through life and all this amount of time has passed and they're still sober and happy, that was the big kicker for me. How can you possibly be happy? And they were. And I just was drawn to them and I stuck to their side. And I mean, we would go to, you know, Denny's or whatever, or IHOP, and, you know, there'd be the circular booths, and they'd stick me in the middle, and then they would, like, surround me, and then they would just, like, beat me up with a bunch of AA, and it was fantastic. And I can't even remember like an actual conversation that we had. All I know is that every time I felt a little safer when I was done with them. And I was taught, you know, you come for the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting. I don't hear that so much in meetings anymore. I was told if you're not 15 minutes early, you're late. And you need to get a commitment and live the triangle. And so I just, you know, I just did what I was told to do to the absolute best of my ability. Because, you know, what I learned here is that, you know, God will do for us what we can't do for ourselves, right? But it also means he will not do for us what we can do for ourselves. You can't just sit at home and think that God is going to, like, pay your mortgage. You got stuff to do. And I honestly have, you know, I have no idea what the hell I'm going to talk about, so you'll just have to bear with me. I always feel like I have to get my legs first, you know. So, my father had 28 pages worth of resentments on my first four-step. And when I was 16 years old, I got beat so badly by my dad that it took 2 months for the bruises to go away. And here's what I can tell you is that he thought he was doing the right thing. He was scared for me, but I didn't know that then. And but without a doubt, it's the most challenging relationship I've had in my life. And I work with my dad today. Like, my mom says that we sound like two, like an old married couple, because, I mean, it's just like, you know, all the time. And but, you know, the difference is that I had like a small rage problem when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was bad. You know, I raged because I had so much pain inside of me. I hurt so badly, and my old timers were like, they were hard on me, and all up until the moment that they were there for me to like collapse in their laps and cry, and then they would hold me and tell me it's going to be okay, you don't ever have to feel like that again, which is, you know, we've heard that, and I was taught some really important lessons, and you know, one of the biggest, you know, things that I was taught is that you cannot allow the life that AA gives you to get in the way of your AA life. And, you know, I have always made AA a priority. You know, I am this very anal retentive type organized person. I'm sure my hairstyle can't give that away at all. And it's that natural look that takes 3 hours to achieve. The pain that I have in comparison to the freedom that I have today, that is a miracle. Because to not have to be the victim to my circumstance, to not have to be a victim to my father, and I don't know, my relationship with God is so, it's so much bigger than everything in the universe. I can't even express to you the relationship that I have with God. When I got here, I hated myself, absolutely hated myself. And I, you know, I'd hear that, you know, people with self-esteem do esteemable acts. You know, like I could come up with a bubble bath. That is all that I knew that was. And what I learned was that I had to stop abandoning myself. And, you know, in the book, I like to talk about the book sometimes. If you hear one thing that I say tonight, the single most important, this is just an old, it's got the surname, but it's the third edition. If you hear one thing that I say tonight, if you're newer in the program or it's been some time since you've done this, the most important thing I'll say tonight is this. find somebody who knows this book, and you sit down with that person, and you let them read it to you line by line. If you don't know a word, you look it up, and then you talk about how it relates to your life, and they will tell you how it relates to your life. And in doing so, I get to walk girls through the steps and walk them through the book. And I got to tell you, like, it literally brings tears to my eyes. There is just nothing in my life that brings me more joy than that. I can't even believe that somebody genuinely wants to know what I know. That's still part of that little wounded little girl inside of me. But you know what? We were talking about this before the meeting. Like, I don't buy my own press. Like, I don't, you know, if somebody's like, wow, that was great, whatever. If I buy into that, then I have to buy into somebody who's going to say something negative. And I already have one person that does that, and that's the disease. And I have had to really learn to identify who's giving me information. And what I know is that when God speaks to me and tells me intuitively the things that I need to do, God will only give me information that leads me towards being happy, healthy, joyous, and free in an unselfish way. If it is anything other than that, and in particular, if it's anything negative, I assure you that's my head trying to kill me. And when I finally realized that it was as cut and dry as that for me, I'm going to say this because I'm going to tell you what I do. This is what I do. What I do is that when I can't seem to, like, when I finally, like, turn on the light and go, oh, my God, that's the disease, and then I literally have to go, nice try, dickhead, try again. You know, because I have no business listening to that guy. That guy doesn't want anything good for me. And I remember the first time I did that around somebody, they're like, what? I'm like, not you, this. I'm just like, I don't know. And I just, you know, the book talks about, you know, the logic center of the brain. That's where God lives. Like, logic's good stuff. We like it. And the thing about, let's see, it's not there. Wait, hold on. Hold, please. Whee! Okay. In the 10th step, it talks about how we can exercise our will along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. And so the thing is that we are like unbelievable willful people. Unbelievably willful people. It's just that I can't will myself to not drink. I can will myself to go to a meeting. I can will myself to pick up the phone and call my sponsor or talk to somebody, rat myself out. I am such a huge proponent of accurate self-reporting. I want to tell you, when I tell you that I had a rage problem, I had a rage problem. Like, seriously, it was ugly. And I went probably 15 years without raging at all, ever. Doesn't mean I didn't feel angry, but I've learned how to just, like, remove myself from difficult situations. And last year sometime, I raged at my father. It was the first time in a long time. But let me tell you something. Here's the upgrade for me. The upgrade is that I didn't name call. I didn't get hit below the belt. I'm trying to clean it up a little bit. My dad yells, you know what I mean? And so sometimes you have to communicate in the way that your audience can hear it. And as soon as I was done, I apologized. And he's like, don't worry about it, because he does that. He flies off the handle. I said, no, Dad, it's not all right. I'm like, you deserve to be treated with respect. I love you. You know, I lost my sister to alcoholism, my sister Tiffany. I was a very late bloomer, very, very late bloomer in life. But my sister was an absolute, I mean, like, walk down the street and people accidentally crash into the car in front of them kind of good looking. And she, you know, people fell all over themselves. Men fell all over her, like literally since kindergarten. And to do, you know, to just try to be in my sister's stratosphere. And when her anniversary of her death, she died in 2011. When she died, I put a picture of her up and just said, you know, it was like in an AA, you know, like my sober friends, you know, I didn't put it like general or whatever, and said, you know, she picked something in your sobriety that you know that you could be doing better and do it for her today. And somebody wrote, God, she's so beautiful. I can't believe that she died of alcoholism. I'm like, really? Because, like, I can't believe that someone who breathes air doesn't. You know what I mean? Like, seriously? Like, if I just, I don't know how people can go through life and not have these tools and not either kill themselves, kill someone else, or drink. Because it was the only thing that would quiet the pain and the rage that I was carrying around. And, you know, when my sister died, there was a blackout in San Diego. Like, the whole city went down. And I went to go try to find ice. And I came back. I was at my folks' house. And I came back, and they were completely weird. Like, they're like, come in, sit down. Like, I don't even understand what was going on. And then they told me that my sister had died. She had shot herself because she was dying of alcoholism. And I wasn't surprised, and I never prayed that she'd get sober, because I was taught we don't pray for stuff that we want. But what I would pray is, not even pray, it was something that I would just throw out to the universe, which is, may she hit her bottom hard and fast in a way that's meaningful to her. And no matter what happens, God, I accept your will with gratitude. And the hardest thing of all of it was when my parents told me, and then my dad, he said, oh my God, my baby's gone. And he started crying. And in that moment, I thought, oh my God, he really does love us. He just doesn't know how to love me in a way that means something to me that I can, you know, like, really feel satisfied with. But it was one of those moments where I told my parent, this is one of those, talk about God doing for you. I said, just like in the middle, I just said, all right, this is what's happening. I said, this is, because I always say that this is happening, because this is, that's the shortest version of the Serenity Prayer for me. This is happening. Be in acceptance right now. Acceptance is being in reality without judgment. It's, let's find a plan of action. You're either in the problem or you're in the solution. And I said, you know, you guys, this is one of those things that's either going to blow our family apart or it's going to bring us together. And we have to decide right now as a family what that is going to be for us. And my parents were like children. They were like, we want to stay together. I said, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to cook for you guys. And if I think you need a hug, you get a hug. If you think I need a hug, you need to give me one. And we're going to take a walk every day, because it was the only thing that I could think of to put one foot in front of the other and not get stuck where the disease wants me. The disease wants that restless irritability and discontentment. And so the other thing that I have that Monty was talking about, I have multiple sclerosis. And so I really struggle with my energy. And but at that time, I was just coming off of the cane. I periodically have to walk with a cane, and I had been on the cane for 6 months, and I had been going to physical therapy to get off the cane. And so the first part of those walks, I would just, you know, I had a cane, and then I didn't have a cane anymore. And we would, sometimes we'd all go, sometimes it'd just be my mom or my dad, and we would just walk, and we would talk, and we would cry, or we would laugh, and we'd just put one foot in front of the other so that we wouldn't be stuck in the pain. And so my sister had died in the month of November, and so her birthday was in April. So her first birthday was going to be coming. So in January, my mom says to me, "Hey, you know what? There's a half marathon on Tiffany's birthday. You want to do it?" I was like, "Yes, absolutely yes. We will figure this out." And I got a book on training for marathons. It was a half one, so I just did half the training. And in this regard, half measures does avail you something. And so I got, you know, the best way to describe my sister and I is like her favorite color is pink and my favorite color is whore red. I mean, come on now. And so I found the pinkest of the pinkest shirts you could possibly find. And I had printed on it, "Team Tiffany for a healthy mind, body, and spirit." And I got one for my dad, and he wore it. My dad had his hips replaced, so he can't run. But my mom and I, we just started plugging away. And it's a trail run. If any of you are runners, let me tell you, that's not the first place you want to start running. That's some work right there. And so 3 weeks before the run, I start feeling like a little sick. And then I end up at the doctor, and she's like, "What's up?" And I'm like, "Well, I think I have bronchitis in one lung." And she's like, "One lung? You know, what? And I'm like, "I don't know." And so she like listens. She's like, "Yeah, let's go get you a chest x-ray." And so she looks at the x-ray. I'm like, "What is it?" She goes, "Well, you have bronchitis in one lung." And so I had to like start taking antibiotics, and I had to like not finish my training, right? And so I'm still, and it was like really a lingering infection. And so I am like on a second course of antibiotics on race day. And so my mom and I are going, and she ended up having a problem with her hip, and she only got halfway through, and she was devastated. And I said, "I'll finish this. I'm doing it." And I have to tell you that, like, it was sort of kind of down, but coming back, it was kind of up. And when I was coming back, I have to tell you, if I wasn't last, I was second to last. And I didn't even care. And you're talking about someone who's so highly competitive. And the last part of the race was up a serious hill. And they were out of water. And there's like two people that are there, and they go, "Oh, wait, here's one more." I'm like, "I need water." And so this gal comes running down the hill, and she's like, "Here, drink mine," because they had no more water. And so she had like this much, and I'm sitting there telling her, I'm like, "My sister died, and I'm running this race for her, and I have bronchitis in one lung," and I, and she's like, it was like, talk about God, just go. I mean, she ran right next to me. She's like, "You're gonna do this." She goes, "Just don't stop. Keep going, keep going, keep going." And I swear to God, I only had one lung, good lung on me right then. And I made it to the top of the hill. And I swear to God, I just can't even believe. It's not that it was that I did that. It's that God put that woman there so I could do that to honor my sister. Because I didn't want to be stuck where the disease wanted me to be stuck. Because my head is always trying to kill me. It's just way more cunning now. And, you know, I had to stop working a full-time job in 2010 because of my MS and the fatigue that I deal with. And God, I've had so much. It's astonishing how much medical stuff I've had. And I had a doctor almost kill me in 2001. And I was in a coma for 6 days. And I had really significant brain damage when I came out. Like, I would lose my train of thought, like, three times in a sentence, which is feeling more familiar as I get older, but it wasn't then. And, you know, that doctor who almost killed me, he tried to change my records to say that he gave me certain medical advice, which he did not. And my mom was smart enough to go get my records when I went into the emergency room. And I had to go to court against this doctor. And I called my sponsor on the drive there, and I was like, you know, you guys have taught me how to live in the moment, right? If you just stay in the right here, right now, it's, you know, I don't, if you got 1 foot in tomorrow, that's where fear and anxiety lives. If you got a bunch of resentment, that's living in yesterday, right? So I was taught if you have 1 foot in tomorrow, 1 foot in yesterday, you're pooping all over today. And so I've gotten very good at just being in the here and now. So I wasn't concerned about going to court until I was actually driving to court. And because had that guy not been like the doctor, he would have been the guy that was like the, at a bare minimum, involuntary manslaughter. But, you know, but I talked to my sponsor and I said, look, I got a lot of noise in my head right now, and I just wanted to be able to be there for myself, you know, and advocate for myself, because that's something you guys have taught me how to do. Stop bailing on me. If I don't want to do something, guess what? I don't. And I can live with people not being happy with me anymore. And it's okay. And I said, what do I do? She said, well, can you imagine for a minute what it's like for the doctor right now? She goes, this guy is so scared he falsified your medical records. This guy just, he broke the law. He's so scared. Can you imagine how much education this guy has had? Can you imagine, like, his reputation that he has, his livelihood, his family? And I, like, for 1 second, I was like, God, he must be scared a lot. And in that second, that minute, that nanosecond of having compassion for this guy, all of my fear vanished, and I was completely right back here and now. And I prevailed, and I don't know whatever happened to him, and I really don't care. And it's not like I don't care because it's not a resentment. Like, I don't need him. I don't need to know that he has suffered. Like, even though I had a big price to pay, the bottom line is that, you know, the truth is that I only see what's in front of me. You know, I see a wall and I think, I've got to get through it. But God has the aerial view, and on the other side of the wall is a cliff. Literally every time, God is watching out for my best interest. God is looking out for all of our best interest. And when I could start getting away from the results, I kind of look at it like you know that you know those shows where they're like, here, just give me three ingredients or whatever you've got in your kitchen and I'll like make something for you, whatever, like a chef show. And if you only give somebody three ingredients, you're only going to get, you know, so many options. But if, you know, if you go, oh my God, I just went to the store, holy cow, look, do this, that, the other thing, and another one, you know, and you give them like 50 ingredients, they're going to make you like the most amazing gourmet meal you've ever had in your life. And this is what I look at footwork to be. Every time I take a little bit of footwork, it's like giving God another ingredient to work some magic and to feed my soul in the way that I need to be fed, not the way I think I need to be fed, but the way God needs to give it to me. And, you know, when I was 3 years sober, God spoke to me. I was having a profound pain. It's around men. You know, because when you have a bunch of baggage around your father, you really end up having a lot of baggage in your relationships. I always say that, like, if it's hysterical, it's historical. Like, if your feelings don't seem to be matching the situation at hand, it's not really about the situation at hand. And I was sobbing. I was so profoundly injured because of what had happened. Like, he broke up with me. Okay, so it's not even like anything, you know, whatever. But I mean, I just couldn't take it. And because I really liked this guy, and it hurt. And I was laying in bed, and I pulled the covers over to kind of get in the fetal position. And in that moment, I felt an arm wrap around me. And it was so scary because I was the only one there that I turned around to look. And no one was there. And so I just cried. And then I heard these words as clearly as I will say them to you. And it was God. God said, "America, I will never give you more than you can handle. You are safe and protected. Even on your worst day, I am proud of you. Even on your worst day, you can never let me down. You are already the woman I know you to be. I'm just waiting for you to see it." And in that moment, pain took on a completely different thing, because my belief system shifted right then and there. That idea that my head wants me to believe that this is too much, I can't handle this, is such a lie, because my proof is always, I have never seen anyone burst into flames because of feelings, nor has it ever happened to me, and that's all the evidence I need. Emotions are so temporary. And what I know is that when I actually stop and honor my feelings, that's by having them in the moment, in real time. Because if I don't, I'm telling God that his plan and what he needs me to do isn't valid. And I have to let those tears out so that I can let, like, the joy in. And to know that I am safe, I never knew that I was safe, ever. I mean, even at, like, in my relationship, like, my boyfriend is 6'4". He's a foot taller than me, because I feel safe around him. That was sort of the initial, you know, thing. And so that sense of, like, safety, because, like, here's the thing about relationships, I'll just, like, real quick. So here's how it works for us. So I am really, how did someone describe me recently? This is their words, not mine, okay? I'm trying to just use a describer of how someone described me, which is, she said, "That's America, and she is a force of nature," which the force is AA and God. But nonetheless, I'm kind of intense. And just sort of like that passive, like, kind of submissive person is not sort of in my nature. But also in relationships, though, you know, if you want to have a balanced relationship, I can't, like, sit there and, you know, be dictating terms and doing all this and, like, basically emasculating the man that's in front of me. Because if I trust his judgment, and if I don't trust the person's judgment, why am I with them? And I told him, I don't know how we even got on the subject. It was early in our dating. And he goes, "So why did you want to keep, you know, why were you interested in going out still?" And I said, "Well, I trust your judgment." He goes, "Well, what do you mean? Like, how?" I said, "Well, my sense is that if something ever happened and I fell down and I was knocked unconscious and I got a big gash on my face, you would not let anyone but a plastic surgeon sew me up in the ER. You know what I mean? Because, like, I don't want some hack in there and then have, like, this big thing on my face. It took a really long time to get here." There was a time in my sobriety that I weighed 268 and a half pounds. And when I tell you I'm a late bloomer, I was a late bloomer. And I had another health issue that was sort of how I got to that spot. And I lived with chronic pain for like 20 years. And I found a doctor that helped me. And it ended up being very emotionally based, my pain. And when I let go of all of that, and sort of the turning point of when that happened actually happened right when I was able to find compassion for that doctor. Because when I did the fourth step and I did all those resentments against my dad, I had such like a real, like in the logic part of my brain, I could really see that he was a spiritually sick person, and I really had a lot of forgiveness for him. And but it didn't change the fact that I had all of this trauma locked in my body, and it was freaking killing me. And I was in so much emotional pain that I was in physical pain. Like when I was 25, I had a doctor offer me a morphine pump as a means of dealing with the kind of pain that I was dealing with. And I was like, I don't think that's conducive for long-term sobriety for me. And to which he goes, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I guess I'm going to just have to be a bitch, you know, because it hurts when you're not nice when you're in a lot of pain. And that was really, and it's shocking to me now that people like say, God, you're so nice. I'm like, really? Like, I mean, because like, I have still such a sense of like, in my family, there was a term that was coined called machete mouth. And that is like who I feel like I am always working against. That's who the disease wants to bring out, because that's the thing that gives me the most restless irritability and discontentment. You know, the steps, I'm going to just say this is the quickest way that I can get through this. This is the steps 1, 2, and 3. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. I heard somebody say that, and it's just completely like sum that up. Steps 4 through 9 allow us to offload all of the restless irritability and discontentment that we carry from our past, all of our secrets, all of our lies, all of the damage. And then 10, 11, and 12 allow us to be present and to carry the message. And if you are here and you have regret, still, I want to tell you something, that the greatest thing that's ever going to happen to you, because at least for me, was that I am, like, there is nothing that I wouldn't tell you guys right up here. In fact, you want to talk about how daddy issues affected me? I dated a married man for some time in sobriety many, many, many years ago. Because I went to see a therapist because I couldn't get out of the relationship. And she said, you know, and I really like to think that I'm a smart person, but I got to tell you, I can't, it's like this woman was speaking Chinese to me when she said it. She said, you're in this relationship because your self-esteem is so damaged that if a relationship doesn't work out, it can be about her and not you. And I could not understand that. And I just kept going to therapy and I kept working through it. And I finally got out of that relationship. And I have no shame in that. That's part of my path. Here's the thing, is that I did all of that work so that I don't have to be that person. There is absolute purpose to your pain. It's the greatest, greatest asset that we have. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like the waves that ebb and flow. It's like one day you're a teacher, next day you're a student, then you're a teacher, then you're a student. One of the reasons this thing works so great is that we're just not all sick on the same day. And, you know, and I am just so incredibly grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I can't believe that I feel comfortable in my own skin. My dad used to weigh my sister and I when we grew up. And if we weren't at the number that needed to be, there were some repercussions. And I absolutely loathed myself. My sister grew up in the exact same household that I did. She was somehow a functional anorexic and an alcoholic. I have a background with food stuff too, and I am an alcoholic. And I've never said, why me and not her? Because that's the way God needed it to be. That's why, and that's a good enough answer for me. Because the thing is that my old timer said, pick something that you're not doing well in your program. I did this at her eulogy. I don't remember this. Somebody told me this. And I said, find something in your life that's related to self-care. Maybe it's your blood pressure. Maybe it's that you don't advocate for yourself in your relationship. It doesn't matter what it is. Like, whatever it is, that there's something that's going on in your life that isn't serving your highest good, and make a complete commitment to work towards God's resolution of what that looks like for you, and donate that. Dedicate it to my sister. That's the best way that you can honor her. Because the thing is that jails, institutions, and death, that is what happens. Seems like I don't even hear that very much in meetings anymore. This is a fatal, fatal disease. And, the thing is that, she left 5 kids behind. And let me just tell you, the thought process that went through my head, which was when I found out she died, I was like, well, she'll never drive drunk in the car again with her kids, and she'll never have to have another nanosecond of that alcoholic hell that we live in when we can't get sober. And if the trade-off is that I don't ever see her again, I'm totally, totally okay with that. Why? Because my mantra is that I accept God's will with gratitude. Because I was taught that the only thing I can control is my attitude and my actions. So I can either be a victim to my circumstance, or I can decide to figure out how to let it empower me and help someone else. If you were frigging dying inside, and it doesn't matter how much time you've got, let me tell you something. There is no safer place in the world to rat yourself out. And the next day after I lost my cool with my father last year, I went to a meeting. And I was like, oh, my God. And I raised my hand to share. I just have to, look. Newcomers need to know we are still frigging human. We make lots and lots of mistakes. There is no shame in our game. The only thing that's wrong is that if we don't try to seek to do something better. And even still, however it's going to turn out is how it's supposed to turn out. I don't dictate terms to God at all. The thing about the MS is that by the way, thank you for recording. And I always, when I come and speak, I always have to listen. The day that I speak, I miss one of the speakers because I can't do all of the days. I can't do the whole day. I have to rest. And I get to rest. You know what I mean? And we live in a world where I can listen to it. And I really wanted to hear the speaker this afternoon. But that's okay, because I can either sit and wallow in the fact that, oh, I didn't get to do that, poor me. Why? Why is restless irritability and discontentment such a problem? I'm so glad you asked. All right. So the doctor's opinion, this was an absolute frigging game changer for me when I got sober, when an old timer took me through the book on this. And he said, we read this, because I don't know my Roman numerals. I literally missed that day in second grade. It's page XXVI, okay. And bottom paragraph. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is interest, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life is the only normal one. So here's this cycle, okay? I was in this cycle, had no idea. We're restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks we see others taking with impunity. After we have succumbed to the desire, again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. You go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging always remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over again. And there's very little hope for us unless we have basically an entire psychic change. And the old timer said, now what's the most important part of that? And the thing that was really surprising to me, I was like, the phenomenon of craving, because here I am thinking I like to party. And he's like, no. He goes, the most important thing is that it starts with too much restless irritability and discontentment. And that will get to a breaking point for us, and we have to drink. And after you get through the steps the first time, I got to tell you what I believe for me, the most important steps. I mean, the 12 steps obviously really important. I sponsor a lot of women. I take a lot of women through the book. That's just a given for me. But in terms of like having a functional friggin' life and not living in restless irritability and discontentment, for me, it is steps 6 and 7. If you're unfamiliar with, the easiest way to work that step is act better than you feel. If you even knew, this is why I have such a hard time when people are like, you're such a nice person, because if you even knew how many times I've murdered you in my mind. I was a Karen before there was a Karen. I haven't been a Karen in a really long time. You know what I mean? And it's like, I can't believe that the transformation, because I did the work. You know, people, something that gets on my nerves is when people say, well, God willing, I'll have, you know, like next, you know, like in July, God willing, I'll have 32 years sober. God's willing. It's the disease that's not. Make no mistake about it. God wants me happy, healthy, joyous, and free. He wants that for all of us, because we can do our best work for him in that state. There's a timer. Is that my timer? No? Okay. I don't know. I'm watching my time. Okay, it's a horn, old school. Okay, which is a little bit the way my brain works before I'm just about to really like want to level somebody, that like there's that pause. And I will tell you that like I've just celebrated my 8-year anniversary last week with my boyfriend. And we've never yelled at each other, like never. Now trust me, that's not in his game plan, but it makes it really difficult for him to yell at me if I don't yell at him. Because if I have literally no, when I'm in a conversation and it starts to become more important for me to say what I need to say next instead of hearing what you have to say, I have absolutely no business being in the conversation at all. Because I can't do God's work under those circumstances. We have an agreement. The agreement is, when somebody says, I need a break, we will stop mid-sentence and walk away. Because as someone who grew up in a home where such ugly words were said, even though they were said in anger, they were so profoundly painful to me. And you can't unring the bell. It's just not okay. I cannot live as a sober woman and treat people the way my disease head tells me I should be treating people. Is it more important for me to be right and to say what I need to say when I feel like I need to say it? Or is it more important for the other person to actually hear what I have to say? And that may mean that I have to have that conversation later. Because if I expect him to treat me with like respect and dignity, guess what? I'm on the hook. And I can't believe that I have the life that I have. I can't believe that, like, I'm sitting here. Like, you got to understand, like, I'm wearing this dress, right? And, like, A, I can get into it. But B, like, that I feel comfortable in it. God, I never felt okay ever. Like, never. Because I just assumed that you guys thought of me the way I thought of me. And here's the thing, is that if you're feeling low, if you're feeling worthless, if you're speaking poorly to yourself, know that God would never speak to you that way. You would also not willingly speak to a child that way. And if you wouldn't speak to a child that way, the rule is for me, if I wouldn't talk to a child that way, I'm not allowed to say it to me. Because God, that damages God's handiwork every time I decide to like skip down the tools with the disease and tell myself what a piece of crap I am. Because I'm not, because God doesn't make crap. God knows I am already the woman I am supposed to be. He was waiting for me to see it. And that's true for all of us. We are all children of God. That love that God, my God can be summed up in two words, unconditional love. It's all I ever wanted in my house. And I got that. You guys told me when I came into AA, you said, we will love you until you can love yourself. And I'm still amazed to this day that you guys still love me. So thank you.